This is DOA News reporting by remote. I'm Michael Brown. U.S. President Joe Biden will unveil a new strategy to combat the dramatic surge of COVID-19 cases across the country during a major White House speech later today. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki told reporters Wednesday that Biden will spell out six methods designed to encourage more Americans to get inoculated against the virus, including involvement of the private sector. Biden's speech comes as the U.S. is experiencing a growing number of COVID-19 infections, hospitalizations, and deaths sparked by the highly contagious Delta variant, which has completely upended the administration's aggressive vaccination efforts during his first months in office. Former Afghan President Ashraf Ghani said Wednesday that he fled his country last month for the United Arab Emirates to avoid bloodshed in the streets of the capital, that is, Kabul, as Taliban insurgents took control. He also denied misusing government funds as he left. Ghani said in a statement he left at the urging of palace security, who advised him that to remain risked setting off the same horrific street-to-street fighting the city had suffered during the Civil War of the 1990s. Ghani denied taking tens of millions of dollars from the Afghan treasury, calling the charges completely false. Former president and his family fled to the UAE shortly before the collapse of the government. And U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is urging the Taliban to allow charter flights to depart Afghanistan, as planes carrying Americans and vulnerable Afghans reportedly have been stranded at the Mazar-i-Sharif International Airport. Via remote, this is VOA News. Officials have raised Hurricane Ida's death toll in Louisiana to 26. The additional 11 deaths all occurred in the city of New Orleans. The announcement was grim news amid signs the city is returning to normal with almost fully restored power and a lifted nighttime curfew. Outside New Orleans, hundreds of thousands of people remained without electricity 10 days after Ida roared ashore from the Gulf of Mexico. North Korea appears to have held a military parade early Thursday. South Korean officials said, though it is not clear what weapons the event may have featured. The event, suspected to be a parade, took place after midnight to mark the 73rd anniversary of the country's national founding, according to the South Korean military officials quoted in the South Yonhap news agency. If confirmed, it would be the third North Korean military parade in about a year and the first since U.S. President Joe Biden took office. Some analysts see the move as a possible way to pressure the U.S. amid stalled nuclear talks, though it would likely be less provocative than a major weapons test. North Korea has rejected the Biden administration's repeated offers to resume talks and has recently threatened a return to tensions after Washington and Seoul held annual joint military drills. The leader of the World Health Organization imploring wealthy countries to forego COVID-19 vaccine booster shots for the rest of the year to ensure that poorer countries have more access to the vaccine. So far, not all countries have followed the WHO's appeal. The WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said he will not stay silent when companies and countries that control the global supply of vaccines think the world's poor should be satisfied with leftovers. Tedros said the third doses may be necessary for the most at-risk populations where there is evidence of waning immunity, but for now, we do not want to see widespread use of boosters for healthy people. Tedros had previously asked rich countries to provide boosters, do not provide boosters until September. Rebel forces from Ethiopia's Tigray region denied reports Wednesday that they had killed dozens of civilians over a two-day period in the Amhara area in early September. For more news, please join us at our website, voanews.com, or the VOA mobile app. I'm Michael Brown, reporting by remote, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbatha in Washington. Today is Thursday, September 9, and here are some of the stories we are covering. ECOWAS leaders sent a message to the military junta in Guinea.
As expected, the summit decided to suspend Guinea from any ECOWAS activities and to ask the AU to do the same.
Analysts fear a rift between Somali president and his prime minister could affect the country's security and elections. Malawi worries vaccine expiration may be due to hesitancy. An official of Zimbabwe's teachers union says a vaccine mandate could violate citizens' constitutional rights. And Kenyan security arrests two members of parliament for roles in alleged murders.
There are those that we know. We have enough intelligence that they are funding the current attacks in the region. They are renowned people in the society, so they facilitate the bandits, they give them food, they give them ammunition and guns.
And Kenya aid groups use the pole of soccer to help homeless youth. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, will be sending a delegation to Guinea today, Thursday, following the military takeover there. Heads of state of the sub-regional grouping convened a virtual emergency summit yesterday in the Ghanaian capital, Accra, on the situation in Guinea and Mali. Senegalese political analyst Ibrahima Khan says the decisions taken on Guinea were predictable.
As expected, the summit decided to suspend Guinea from any ECOWAS activities and to ask the AU to do the same. Two, apparently they've made their mind about the presidency of Alpha Conde because they're asking the junta to at least start having an idea of how long the transition will take and to explain that to them. And third, they asked for the release of Alpha Conde and also asked the junta to treat Alpha Conde very, very well. Finally, the ECOWAS summit decided to send on Thursday a delegation to start talk with the junta about the implementation of these decisions.
I had an interview with the main opposition leader, Selu Dalein Diallo. He hopes that ECOWAS will help the military or the Guinean people put together a good transition that will eventually lead to free and fair election. Would that be the purpose of the trip to Guinea that ECOWAS is planning?
Yes, part of it. I think the big chunk of it will be to discuss the transition, but also to see the way that they are treating the former president. But I personally believe that, yes, ECOWAS can support, ECOWAS can help, ECOWAS can monitor the implementation. But the decision, the content of the transition depends on what the Guineans want themselves. They need to sit together and define the different thing that needs to be done during the transition. And I think when Dalein Diallo said the support of the ECOWAS, I believe based on the experience that we had in many, many transitions, particularly the ones in Mali, ECOWAS needs to deploy very experienced people, but also to put in place systems that allow a close monitoring of the situation.
Talking about Mali, the former Nigerian president, the envoy of ECOWAS, Goodluck Jonathan, was in Mali this week. And it seemed to me that he wasn't very happy with the progress towards democratic rule in Mali.
Yes, and with a lot of reasons. Even the summit was dedicated not only to Guinea-Conakry, but the summit also discussed the issue of Mali. The summit completely endorsed what the mediator was asking the government to really clarify all the issues related to the transition, the different steps that needs to be taken by the government to make sure that they meet the deadline, which is in the next 6 months. And I think those clarifications now are asked to the military government.
Back to the ECOWAS decision on Guinea. One can say that these decisions, the steps that ECOWAS have taken were predictable, which raises the bigger question: why didn't ECOWAS act to prevent a military takeover in Guinea?
Very good question. I think how I read the decision, I think ECOWAS took lessons from its old failure. Because if you recall, in Mali, the first thing that they decided was to make sure that Ibeka comes back to power. And it's when they knew that it was no longer possible then they accepted the military power. But this time, knowing that at the heart of this political crisis in Guinea-Conakry was the third term, and knowing that they failed to really persuade Alpha Conde not to go in his plan to have a third term. So they know that that was a failure from ECOWAS. So that's why I think it was very easy for them to say, okay, Conde's chapter is over. Let's try to do something else. And that's why I hope that this time ECOWAS next summit will dedicate some time to look at the third term issues.
Ibrahim Akar, thanks so much always for speaking with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me. I also really appreciate them.
Ibrahim Akar is a Senegalese political analyst. He was speaking with us from the capital, Dakar. Gambian President Adama Barrow's political party announced this week an alliance with the party of former President Yahya Jammeh. Activists and human rights groups in the country say the alliance was a betrayal. Barrow's party and his allies grouped together to oust Jammeh after his 22-year rule of the country, during which many human rights groups say atrocities such as murder, rape, and more were committed by the regime. Jeffrey Smith, founder of Vanguard Africa, spoke to Ricky Stryak about what it might mean for Gambians who are seeking justice for alleged crimes during Jammeh's rule.
I think there's been, some pretty widespread disappointment with President Barrow, given what is perceived by Gambians to be the slow pace of reforms on the economic and political fronts after a very fast start in early 2017 when he and the coalition that backed him first emerged to power. My sense is that the president saw his popularity waning. Former President Jammeh's party does remain quite popular in some areas of the Gambia.
And so while this can be described as a shrewd political move, what kind of impact do you think it will have on the Gambian population in general? I mean, is this a betrayal for people who voted for him?
Absolutely. I think if you talk to or even see some of the comments on social media and elsewhere by Gambians, especially the Gambian activists, very vibrant activist community both in the country and the diaspora, there's a sense of betrayal across the board. I think my personal opinion as well, having worked with Barrow and the coalition that came to power in 2016, this really is, I agree, it's a betrayal of the democratic transition that we saw in the Gambia in January 2017, one that inspired Gambians, also jeopardizes the many important steps in the Gambia that have been taken towards reconciliation, justice, and accountability for the crimes committed, the heinous, very serious crimes against humanity that were committed by the Jammeh regime.
All right, Jeff, what kind of impact will this have, you think, on the Truth, Reconciliation, and Reparations Commission, which is looking into crimes that were committed during Jammeh's tenure as president?
One important thing to know, first and foremost, is that the Justice Ministry and the institutions, the state institutions in the Gambia that are charged with implementing and safeguarding and furthering the steps towards accountability and justice following the Jammeh dictatorship are strong. There are strong leaders in place. There are strong institutions in place that are in many ways separate from the office of the president, from the office of the executive. So I have no doubt that that important work will continue. Obviously, it becomes a bit more politically tenuous and a bit more contentious with this informal agreement that is apparently signed by Jammeh's former party and the current ruling government. With that said, I think while it does jeopardize these important steps that have been made, I remain confident in the leadership at these very important institutions that have committed to seeing this through, as well as the Gambian people. You know, survey after survey will show that Gambian citizens writ large support in overwhelming numbers these important steps for justice and reconciliation and for accountability for their former leaders who ruled with an iron fist and who, really denied human rights of Gambian citizens for over two decades. So I'm confident in that regard that those important steps will continue, though these current or more recent developments are certainly a cause for concern, and we need to keep a close eye on that.
That was Jeffrey Smith, founder of Vanguard Africa. He was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Washington. Somalia's president and prime minister appeared locked in a power struggle over the country's spy chief and the death of a cybersecurity agent. Prime Minister Mohamed Hussein Roble this week suspended the head of the National Intelligence and Security Agency, Fahad Fassin, for failing to investigate the agent's death. But the president rebuked the move and on Wednesday appointed Yassin as national security advisor. Mohamed Kahir reports from Mogadishu.
President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo reshuffled top positions in the security sector Wednesday, appointing suspended spy director Fahad Yassin as his national security advisor, while installing former Benin Regional Intelligence Chief Colonel Yassin Abdullahi as acting director of the National Intelligence and Security Agency, NISA. Troubler described the president's move as an obstruction of justice toward the investigation of alleged death of a young female spy, Ikram Talil Farah. Farah disappeared in June and was declared dead by NISA this month, though the spy agency has yet to disclose any details about her passing. Political analyst Hassan Modane says the bitter exchange between the office of the president and his prime minister could weaken cooperation between the federal government institutions. He says various institutions, such as the judiciary, presidency, security departments mainly in the capital Mogadishu, as well as the fight against the armed group Al-Shabaab, will be affected by the wrangles. He added that the election process, coordinated by the Office of the Prime Minister, will also be tested. The elections for 19 remaining seats in the upper house of parliament and 275 members of the lower house are expected to kick off shortly in Somalia's slow-moving election process. But according to security analyst Samira Ahmed of Hiral Institute, the tiff between two top leaders will make the work of the Somali security agencies and their international partners very hard. She said the prime minister was tasked to spearhead the election process, which was in good shape so far, but this latest difference between his office and that of the president may impact on the security and damage the credibility and confidence in the election process. She added that, in terms of perception, it also damages the legitimacy of the state-building process in the eyes of the Somali people and their international partners as well. In a joint press statement, the leaders of the opposition, who are also presidential candidates, threw their weight behind Prime Minister while timing the actions of the president as derailing the ongoing election process. Mohamed Kahir for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, September 9th. Kenya's multi-agency security operatives have been deployed to restore peace in the volatile Al-Muran area of Laikipia County after suspected bandits set ablaze a primary school in the area. There was a fierce shootout on Tuesday this week as attempts by security forces to flush the bandits out proved futile. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA, two members of parliament were arrested Wednesday for their alleged connection to the ongoing Laikipia violence.
More than seven people, among them three police officers, have been killed. More than 40 houses torched as one school was set ablaze by suspected bandits in Kenya's Laikipia County. Security operation is ongoing in the volatile Al-Muran area. As the Rift Valley Regional Commissioner George Natembeya says, the bandits are in possession of M16 heavy firearms, mostly in possession of foreign troops from the United Kingdom who train in the area.
We have those M16 rifles in the area. I tried to register illegal firearms when I was working in the area, and the people brought a lot of rifles, especially from the areas of Laikipia North and Isiolo North. They brought the rifles, and all of them were M16 and were new. When we asked them, they said that the UK troops training in Laikipia sometimes throw away those rifles, and some just give them to pastoralists as they create rapport with the residents. So, sources of illegal firearms finding their way into Kenya are many, and we won't finish this problem until we seal these loopholes.
Local residents are fleeing the area for fear of attacks, as former Laikipia North Member of Parliament Matthew Lempurkel and Tiati Member of Parliament William Kamket are said to be charged in court over incitement on the ongoing banditry attacks at the Laikipia Nature Conservancy and the surrounding areas. Natembeya says Mr. Lempurkel and Kamket are among the suspects believed to be inciting the attacks in Laikipia County.
There are those that we know. We
have enough intelligence that they are funding the current attacks in the region. They are renowned people in the society, so they facilitate the bandits, they give them food, they give them ammunition and guns. They hold meetings that are more of bandits swearing to kill, and the meetings are very secretive.
Schools in the area have been closed as government imposes dusk to dawn curfew to contain the situation. Kenya's Deputy President William Ruto has faulted security bodies following the insecurity situation.
What is going on in Laikipia is an embarrassment to the security apparatus in Kenya, and they need to up their game. The same enthusiasm they demonstrate elsewhere, they should when they are protecting the lives of ordinary citizens. And every one of us must come together. Every citizen must equally play their role in ensuring that we support the provision of security in our areas, and we must also involve ordinary people.
Leaders in the region have called on government to restore peace. Laikipia Governor Ndiritu Muridhi says the response by security personnel is not yielding any results.
The response is not vigorous enough, and it is not yielding any results. So we cannot help but think like that. Now, our expectation is that perhaps the ministry looks at the command structure in the whole security operation and tries to figure out why is it not as effective.
Pastoralists in the area have always had boundary dispute with the ranch owners as they invade the ranches looking for water and grass for their animals. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
The vice president of the Zimbabwe Rural Teachers Union says while he welcomes the government's desire to get all Zimbabweans vaccinated for COVID-19, he feels the idea of a mandate for government workers may violate their constitutional rights. Gipse Mushanga says every Zimbabwean has a constitutional right to accept or deny to take the COVID-19 vaccine. This week, Zimbabwe Justice Minister Ziyambi says government workers who do not want to be vaccinated against COVID-19 should resign from their government jobs. He said the government did not intend to force citizens to take the vaccine, but that each had a responsibility to the nation. Mushanga says the government could have first educated the public about the importance of vaccination.
The issue of vaccination against COVID-19 is a thing of national interest. Every Zimbabwean is concerned about being vaccinated. However, there are some measures that we find being not popular with us as educationists and as civil servants at large. To say, if you are not getting vaccinated anytime soon, you should resign from the service. Honestly speaking, we understand that people have got their rights. We are not in disagreement in any way that we can not abide by the recommendations that are being proffered by the government. Yes, this is an issue that is meant to promote health systems in this country, and there is no way we can go against it. But the threatful manner in which it is now being presented to the workers now really shows that there is now stripping off of one is constitutional rights, and we cannot sit back, fold our hands as we watch our constitutional rights being infringed. Let us work hand in glove, the government and the workers. Let us work with engagement. Let us work with education. Let us work with awareness campaigns, further awareness campaign. The government should not lose heart to say, we have told them today they did not comply. Therefore, if they can't ship in, let them ship out. That principle does not promote harmonization.
I hear you talk about government should respect the constitutional right of individuals. What right are you talking about?
A simple constitutional right is one which is on section 6.1, where it is clearly says that every person has the right to freedom of conscience. And this includes freedom of thought and freedom of opinion. In that case, it means if my conscience tells me that I am not ready to be vaccinated, if my conscience tells me that I'm not ready to receive this medical attention, and I view differently from the opinion of the policy implementer, that constitutional right should be respected. and I will have to ensure that I have safeguard, I have put in place all the measures that will protect that constitutional right. That is why we are saying we are in agreement with the government to ensure that all the citizens of the country have been vaccinated. But only where we differ is where we find the measures being put in place having a cohesion part.
The last time I spoke with the teachers' union, you were concerned that the government should pay teachers' risk allowances. You were also concerned about personal protective equipment. Have all these been provided by the government?
We wanted to appreciate the fact that the government acknowledged that there is need to give teachers a risk allowance, and that has been effected about 3-4 months ago. We want to acknowledge receipt of that amount, but our greatest concern now is it is meager, it is paltry, it cannot meet the demands we intend to use it for. We are talking of a very lethal disease.
Gibson Mushanga is vice president of the Zimbabwe Rural Teachers Union. He was speaking with us from the capital, Harare. Malawi health authorities fear vaccine hesitancy could lead to tens of thousands of COVID-19 jabs expiring early next month. With just 2% of Malawi's population vaccinated, authorities hope to increase uptake by deploying mobile vaccination clinics to bring the vaccine closer to the people. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Malawi has so far received just over 1.2 million doses of the Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca vaccines under the COVAX facility. But vaccine hesitancy in Malawi is widespread just because of misperceptions of the jab's efficacy and safety. Dr. Gift Kawalazira, who heads the Health and Social Services at the Blantyre Health Office, says there is another reason for the low vaccination rate.
So we have noticed that with the coming in of summer, the number of cases have drastically reduced, and also the number of people coming for vaccinations have reduced from having over 2,000 people per day to having just about 400 people per day now.
Dr. Kawalazira said deploying mobile vaccination centers will help increase vaccine uptake, noting that when the initiative was launched Saturday, over 600 people were vaccinated and six companies booked the mobile clinic to come and vaccinate their workers. He predicts the initiative will help Malawi meet its vaccination target by 60% by 2022 and allay fears that more vaccines will expire.
Johnson is actually expiring after December, but AstraZeneca got two different batches. One of it is expiring next month, and the other one is going up until December.
In May, Malawi incinerated about 20,000 AstraZeneca doses that had expired after many people refused the jab due to concerns about its safety and efficacy. Malawi Health Ministry statistics show that currently only about 700,000 people have had one jab, while about 400,000 are fully vaccinated, representing 2.1% of the 18 million population. Simeon Piri got his jab Wednesday at a mobile COVID-19 vaccination clinic at Limbe Market in
Blantyre.
He told VOA that this has helped me a lot because it has provided me easy access to the vaccine instead of walking a long distance. I came here to Limbe to do some errands, but I also have found an opportunity to get vaccinated. To increase uptake in rural areas, the government is currently working with traditional leaders to mobilize and tell their communities about the need to be vaccinated when the mobile clinics visit their villages. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
And that's it for this Thursday, September 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you will have a very good day.
Stay informed and up to date Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC with VOA's International Edition. Our correspondents bring you the news from around the globe, plus we delve into the context of the day's biggest stories with interviews with experts that place the story into context to understand why it matters. VOA's International Edition, your best source for news and information.